During last fall's gubernatorial campaign, some Arizona Republicans floated the idea of eliminating the personal income tax. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll talk about a new report that says Arizona could get rid of the income tax without causing extra problems. Economist Steven Slavinsky and Jim Rounds will join me. Plus, the Valley has been a haven for a group of Republicans who may or may not run for president. That has included Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, and Rand Paul. How do they feel about immigration reform, and how big an issue will it be in the campaign? I'll ask ASU political scientist Rudy Espino. And what about the Democratic Party? How have immigrants affected it? I'll talk to an editor from The Nation. And Arizona had a rocky history with Martin Luther King Day. Then Governor Evan Meekum overturned an executive order making the holiday official, and it took more than 6 years for Arizona to become the first state to have a voter-approved King Day. I'll talk with a man who was in the middle of that battle, Reverend Warren Stewart. He has a new book. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Obama is making the case that climate change is a national security issue. NPR's Tamara Keith reports Obama spoke today at the commencement for the United States Coast Guard Academy in Connecticut.
Obama told the cadets that climate change will affect everything they do in their careers.
So I'm here today to say that climate change constitutes a serious threat to global security, an immediate risk to our national security. And make no mistake, it will impact how our military defends our country. And so we need to act, and we need to act now.
Obama said there will be an increasing number of climate refugees, and he said severe drought and crop failures can lead to civil unrest and openings for terrorist groups. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
Gallons of crude oil now stain a four-mile stretch of scenic California coastline not far from Santa Barbara. An environmental cleanup crew is working this hour to eliminate the slick along Refugio State Beach. A broken onshore pipeline spewed down a storm drain and into the ocean for several hours yesterday before it was shut off. The Coast Guard is now determining the size of the spill, which was initially estimated to be about 21,000 gallons. Portions of the Patriot Act passed after 9/11 will expire June 1st. They include Section 215, which authorizes the National Security Agency's collection of millions of Americans' phone records, details of which were leaked to the public by former NSA analyst Edward Snowden. The Senate is expected to vote this week on a House bill that would end the NSA's bulk collection. NPR's Elsa Chang says President Obama does not object.
White House says it supports the House bill. I mean, because it's a great middle ground. There are provisions in the House bill that overlap with proposals the White House has itself suggested quite a while ago. Like under the House measure, there's another provision that would provide for a panel of experts to advocate for privacy and civil liberties concerns before this secret intelligence court, where a lot of these 215 requests go to.
The president of Burundi is bending to pressure and agreeing to delay parliamentary elections by 1 week, but NPR's Gregory Warner reports that decision is doing little to halt violent street protests.
The protesters say they won't leave the streets of Bujumbura, the capital, until Burundi's president agrees not to run for a third term. The protests have paralyzed the country. Today, police dragged off several protesters and fired tear gas. Burundi's opposition and church leaders and other African leaders have all urged the president to delay the elections to ease tensions in this divided country. Today, the president did agree to a one-week delay. Separately, shots were fired at the offices of the representative of the European Union in Bujumbura, prompting the mission to demand that the government improve security. Gregory Warner, NPR News, Nairobi.
You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Kaspersky, giving 400 million individuals and organizations the power to protect against cyber criminals, hackers, and other internet threats. Learn more at Kaspersky.com. That's KASPERSKY.com.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. Two men who were convicted of running mortgage fraud schemes in Arizona are headed to federal prisons. KJZZ's Dennis Lambert has more.
A judge has sentenced 44-year-old Paxton Anderson, who now lives in Minnesota, to 8 years behind bars, and Joseph Planey, a Texas resident, to 4 years. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Arizona says Anderson was a general contractor for Dynamite Custom Homes and JR Custom Homes in Phoenix between 2004 and 2007, and Planey was his bookkeeper. Evidence at their trial showed the two used inflated appraisals to get construction loans for substantially more money than the fair market value of the properties. They then used the construction loan money for personal expenses instead of using it to build homes. The scheme involved homes in Apache Junction, Scottsdale, Mesa, Prescott, and Fountain Hills, among other places. Dennis Lambert, KJZZ News.
From the KJZZ Newsroom, I'm Carrie Young. A federal judge has agreed to allow lawyers for Arizona and the American Civil Liberties Union to continue their efforts to settle a legal dispute over a 2014 law targeting so-called revenge porn. The law makes it a crime for people to post nude photos of their former partners online. A U.S. District Court judge said she'd keep blocking the law pending an agreement or changes made in a special legislative session. A hearing has been set for August 31st.
Wickenburg's police chief has been selected to become police chief in Paradise Valley. The town has announced the selection of Peter Winger to be Paradise Valley's new police chief with a tentative start date of June 29th. We'll see mostly sunny skies today in the valley, a high near 93 degrees. We reached 87 for the high yesterday. Clear skies overnight, a low in the upper 60s, and more sunshine tomorrow. The high expected to reach 90 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by AZ Kebab House, located near Harkins 101 off of Mayo in Scottsdale, serving Chef Arif's authentic Persian dishes, fire-roasted gyros, chicken, beef, and lamb kebabs, fresh baklava, and tea. azkebab.com.
Right now, under partly sunny skies, we have 19% relative humidity, and it's 80 degrees in Phoenix at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, could Arizona actually eliminate the personal income tax? A new report says yes. I'll talk with economist Stephen Slavinsky and Jim Rounds. Plus, Arizona's seen a lot of visits already from some presumed Republican presidential candidates, but is any of them going to push for immigration reform, comprehensive or otherwise? We'll talk about that. And Arizona has a rocky history with Martin Luther King Day. A new book by one of the people at the center of that battle covers all the ins and outs. Reverend Warren Stewart will join me to talk about that book, Victory Together. We start today's program with advances by the so-called Islamic State in Ramadi, Iraq. How involved is the U.S. and what is the U.S. strategy? For insights, I'm joined by Paul Kinsinger, professor at the Thunderbird School at ASU and a former member of the U.S. intelligence community. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Good talking to you.
Paul, what happened in Ramadi and how significant a piece is that for ISIS or ISIL to claim?
Well, it appears that the Islamic State was able to move back into much of or all of Ramadi in the last week or so, and they are making some, sounds like some significant advances in the Palmyra region in central Syria as well. And this is part of the larger back and forth that we have seen now over the last two-plus years with regard to Islamic State and whatever forces of the governments of Iraq and Syria, respectively, are doing to try to stop them. And I think what we have seen in this seesaw kind of effort is that this is, you know, their ability to do this is a direct result, I think, of a couple of things. One is, strategically, it's a direct result of the fact that both these Iraqi and Syrian central governments are relatively weak and are not all that interested in holding Islamic State back because of sectarian differences in these two countries. And, you know, the Sunni-Shia split. The second tactical piece is that I think Islamic State has recognized in, say, the last year or so of open fighting in various parts of the area that they're going after, that they, if they engage in straight-up combat with Iraqi forces or Kurdish forces where they are vulnerable to U.S. air power, they're probably going to come out on the losing end. However, if they take advantage of asymmetrical opportunities like storming Ramadi in a sandstorm to begin with, they negate that factor. And they're starting to figure these things out. So, you know, this kind of warfare is a tit-for-tat thing. And on the tactical side, the forces opposing ISIS will have to figure out how to respond to that. Well, but the larger strategic issue is the bigger question. So,
yeah, Paul, so what involvement does the U.S. have now in terms of training, actual fighting, and strategy? I mean, how vital a piece does the U.S. consider that to be, or is this just more about making sure they knock down ISIS?
Well, I think it's more the latter. I think it's more a containment issue for the United States. This is principally a problem for these two countries and for the Kurds and the neighboring Sunni Arab countries, Turkey and the Gulf Arabs, more than it is for the United States. You know, we have these occasional hostage situations that bring ISIS to the front pages here, but
It's more contained to peace. I think the larger picture for us is that we are seeing the limitations of the government that in Iraq that we helped bring about through the invasion of this country 12, 13 years ago. And the fact that it's mostly a Shia-dominated government, which is still does not include very many Sunnis and is not representative of the Sunni population in Iraq. And, in fact, it appears that a lot of Shia in Iraq have pretty split opinions about what to do with the Sunnis. So the Sunnis are in a vulnerable place in Iraq, and ISIS is largely a Sunni rebellion. So that's a key challenge, whether the Iraqi government can muster what it's going to take to rally Sunni support in Iraq against a Sunni rebellion. It doesn't look too good at this point. On the and that has, of course, obvious implications for U.S. Strategy in the larger sense in the Middle East, because we'd like to see Iraq come back together in some kind of stable government, but that hasn't happened.
Yeah, and Paul, considering that a majority of Americans is tired from the long fights in Iraq and Afghanistan, do you think the U.S. will do everything possible to avoid sending in thousands of troops? And I guess from a military and intelligence standpoint, does that make the most sense to not do that, or does it make sense to do it if we don't take into account how people really feel about that?
No, I think it doesn't make sense to go in there. It's not a boots-on-the-ground situation for the U.S. This is not a U.S. fight. It is principally an Iraqi-Syrian fight. The problem is these countries, as they are currently defined, are falling apart. And there is no, this is a little bit like the Humpty Dumpty fable, right? I'm not sure how we put Humpty Dumpty back together again after 100 years of these countries being defined by borders and colonial powers that were created for them. The three most vulnerable countries in the Middle East today are Iraq, Syria, and Libya. And all three are struggling with the lack of a cohesive national message. And there's no surprise because they are a collection of tribes or sects, and they were forced into these country borders by outside powers. And this is now coming apart, and it may not ever go back together again the way it was for the past 100 years. And that's allowed ISIS to thrive because they're essentially working in a power vacuum and are attracting minorities and majorities, and minority Sunnis in Iraq and majority Sunnis in Syria, who are essentially out of power. So that's the larger equation. Yeah. It is something that's going to have to be resolved by the peoples in the area. The United States wants to, you know, there's an outcome we'd like to see, I'm sure, but this is not solvable by us.
Paul, how much of a potential powder keg is this for the U.S.? And I guess I'm sort of looking for a comparison, how the relative strength of ISIS or ISIL compares with where Al-Qaeda was at, for example, right before 9/11.
Yeah. Well, it's a little hard to it's a little bit of an apples and oranges thing because ISIS's true goals are really in the region. Hmm. They've made, you know, some big bold threats about bringing the fight to the West and so on and so forth. But, you know, we haven't really seen much of that. And I think their passion, their heart is really about resolving the situation between Sunnis and Shias in the Fertile Crescent area, and bringing about some new arrangement of power in that part of the world. To the degree they threaten the United States or the West in general, I think is more about getting us to pay attention to that and get us off their backs, as opposed to Al-Qaeda, which is take the fight to us. So I don't see these guys in the same boat as Al-Qaeda. In that sense, they have more regional aspirations than Al-Qaeda had.
Paul, in our last 90 seconds or so, sorry to drag you into the realm of politics, but because we're going to have a lot of potential presidential candidates coming up, is this a situation where U.S. policy needs to dramatically change, or if another person or a different party is in the White House next time, will they see a different reality than they're seeing right now not being in the White House?
Well, it is certainly going to come up in the political season here, there's no question. I think the challenge for Republicans is going to be, how do you rattle sabers about this part of the world when half the Republican potential candidates are already stumbling over the question of would you have gone into Iraq in 2003 if you knew what we know now? I don't see how they get out of that box. It's a very deep, very steep box. And I don't know how you argue yourself out of that one and try to talk Americans back into sending people back or soldiers back into this part of the world. Very difficult. So I think there'll be some rattling of sabers on the right, particularly in the primary period. But It seems to me it's pretty easy to take the steam out of that with some very pointed questions from the media.
Paul Kinsinger of the Thunderbird School at ASU and a former member of the U.S. intelligence community. Paul, we always appreciate your time. Thanks.
You're welcome, Steve. Good talking to you.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Eliminating the personal income tax in Arizona is a topic that's been floated before, but the average Arizonan may not have heard non-economists talk about it until last fall, when a number of Republican candidates for governor sounded as if they were believers in the concept. A new report authored by economist Steven Slavinsky of the Center for the Study of Economic Liberty at ASU says the idea is, in fact, viable. He joins me now, as is Jim Rounds, senior economist and senior vice president for Elliott D. Pollack & Company. Welcome, guys. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. Thanks for having us on.
So, Stephen, how long would it take to phase this kind of concept in so that it didn't really throw people off too much?
Sure. Well, it depends on a couple different things. The first is it depends on what the economic growth potential and trajectory of the state looks like. And so one thing I think it's missing from a lot of the discussion, or at least has been up until recently, is what moving parts need to be considered or sort of isolated, in a sense, to figure out how we do this over the longer term. I think it can be feasibly done in probably no more than 7 or 8 years if a couple of things happen. One is we have historically possibly might call them normal growth patterns in terms of revenue and economic growth. And I'm thinking about kind of average patterns of growth that we've seen even over the past two business cycles, not just the last one, but sort of in the aggregate last 15 years or so, kind of a general expectation of overall economic growth. But also a very important part of this is tax reform is unfortunately up until very recently been thought of or discussed in a vacuum, independent and disassociated from what we're doing on the spending side, on the expenditure general fund budget side at the state legislative level. So an important part of this is also going to be over that 7 to 8 year period is having some kind of spending discipline, the likes of which we really haven't seen up until very recently. Keeping the government, or rather I should say the budget, structurally balanced over that period is going to be a real critical factor, not just in, I guess, aligning people's expectations about budget growth, but also in making sure that the tax reforms can remain intact and not get upset over that 7 or 8 year period.
Jim, we'll come back to spending discipline, but I want to get your point of view on economic growth, because that has been one of those things that obviously the Great Recession seemed to have dashed what the new normal is. And so people wonder about what economic growth looks like. From that standpoint, is the state in a position, as we're finally seem to be sort of getting some normalcy, where we can see the economic growth that Steve's talking about to make this a possibility?
Yeah, well, the economic growth, you have to put it in the context of where we were. And so we just went through the best case study of what Arizona looks like if growth wasn't part of our economic base. But we're still showing statewide growth rate in terms of jobs of around 2.5%. Greater Phoenix area, it's closer to 3%. And so even without one of our core things that allow us to prosper, we're still actually doing okay. And then when you start to add that extra growth back in from construction and the other related industries, we might be hitting 3.5%, 4% growth. Now, that's not a boom. It's still less than what we would normally experience. But I think people need to be a little bit more optimistic about where we're going as an economy right now, because you have to think about, what would we have expected this recovery to look like? What would the numbers have looked like before the growth industries kick in? And then what will they look like afterwards? And when you break it down, we have some good opportunities.
Steve, when it comes to spending discipline, for some people that is certainly a buzzword. The feeling is, well, wait a second, are you going to just spend on a few different things, and how are we going to make that work? What sort of evolution, or to some devolution, are we going to see when it comes to that? Like, what sort of spending caps are you talking about, that kind of thing?
Sure. Well, a lot of this comes down to an institutional question of how we actually construct the budget every year. What we do at the state level, it's called baseline budgeting, in a sense. And the expectation is you take everything you did last year and just haggle over what the growth rate's going to be for the next year. That's actually rather difficult way of doing budgeting, because you back yourselves into a corner in a way. So I think, first of all, we need to have some kind of structural change in the budget process to allow more time and deliberation to bring back in. We actually have a committee called the Joint Legislative Audit Committee that actually has been relatively dormant for a number of years. And so I like the idea of bringing back in a more critical eye to what we spend the money on. Mm. But once we do that and we sort of start weeding out savings, there is that question about how much do you grow in every future year. In the feasibility studies that I've done in my recent analysis on this question, you can actually get about a 2.3% 6% growth rate every year on average for the next 7 or 8 years. So that still maintains anywhere between a $250 million or so dollar growth in government spending for every year, each and every year for that 7 or 8 year period, and still maintain budget balance and still buy down, in a sense, the income tax over that period of time.
Steve, short answer before we go to break, because I know there are going to be some listeners who are concerned saying, well, if you cut back, we've already seen cutbacks when it comes to who's on the Medicaid rolls, and how are these people who are really struggling going to be taken care of? Any thoughts on that? Because that's a real issue for a lot of people out there.
Sure. And spending portion, spending control really is only one part of that equation. We have to be thinking about, though, is once we get to a point where we're trying to get people into the workforce and sort of these work requirements are kicking in for these means-tested entitlement programs, we have to make sure that there's actually jobs for them to go back to. And so I think a large part of tax reform that's sort of generally inferred is the idea of the unlocked economic potential that could come from actually reforming the tax code. And I think a tax code that actually is more conducive to investment and job creation is one that is actually a lower income taxes, and as a result actually create more job growth and more business starts to generate that job growth over time.
We're talking about personal income tax elimination and the broader questions surrounding it with Stephen Slavinsky and Jim Rounds. We'll continue with that discussion coming up in just a moment on Here and Now.
KJZZ is supported by Phoenix Country Day School Summer Programs, offering summer fun with arts, sports, and academics for children from kindergarten through high school, June 8th through July 17th. Program details at pcds.org/summer.
Good morning. This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Join us today at 1 for BBC News Hour. A mostly to partly sunny day expected across the state today. Right now, it's sunny and 81 degrees in Tucson, 81 in Casa Grande as well. It's 67 in Prescott. Cloudy skies, 58 degrees in Flagstaff. It's cloudy and 84 in Yuma. Checking Valley traffic right now on I-10 eastbound. Watch out for a crash on the exit ramp at 7th Avenue. And on I-17 southbound, there's a crash blocking the shoulder at Central. Thank you for making the $10 Tuesday member drive a success. Your monthly sustaining contributions are vital to providing the news and information you rely on. All contest winners are posted at KJZZ.org. Your support is sincerely appreciated. Thank you. It's partly sunny and now 84 degrees in Phoenix at 11:22.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We're talking about tax reform with Stephen Slavinsky of the Center for the Study of Economic Liberty at ASU and Jim Rounds, Senior Economist and Senior Vice President for Elliott D. Pollack & Company. Jim, I want to look at some of the broader issues, but when we think about income tax elimination, there are certain states who seem to be pretty successful doing it. Does Arizona have what it takes to pull that off? It's often compared to Texas. People will say, well, Texas has certain built-in advantages, certain industries that seem to be strong no matter what, even survive the Great Recession. Does Arizona have that kind of thing at this point?
Well, we can't oversimplify what makes an economy tick. And so I think people should relax a little bit on this report, because what Steve laid out where it was a lot of the math that's required to show what rates would have to be if we were going to be revenue neutral, what other taxes would have to be increased. It kind of gave a little bit of a template on some ideas. Now, if it was just used to justify a tax cut and not consider anything else that helps make an economy tick, then I would have an issue with it. And often, and like this is what Steve also mentioned, we talk about taxes, but we don't talk about the spending side. We have to match revenues and expenditures, otherwise we have deficits. But I'd like to expand that even further. I view this as like maybe one of a dozen stepping stones on what we need to look at in terms of reform. So we have a report that talks about the income taxes, and you knew that this was going to be coming up over the next couple of years, individual income tax reform. But I would also like to know, at what point do we need to talk about proper levels of transportation infrastructure investment, even some of the education investment? But what I like about this issue is that maybe this will spur some of the other groups into putting in some very careful thought on specific issues. And one of my issues has been with the education community. I would like them to reduce some of their issues down into 3 or 4 or 5 items and research the heck out of it, show some cost-benefit analysis, and then have an intelligent conversation about what we want to do in terms of investing in our infrastructure. infrastructure. And then you blend that with what do we want to do in terms of having a competitive tax code? Blend that with what do we want to do on economic development policies and how we market the state? So if we view this as part of a number of steps going forward, then I have no problem with it. But if some policymakers just try to jump on one report and try to justify cutting taxes and they don't put thought into it, then we're going to have the same problems that we've had in the past.
Steve, I'm going to boil this down way too simply. It's a 30-page report. There's so much more to it. Obviously, you've put a lot of time into it. But one of the things that comes up as well is, okay, is there going to be a need? Talked about the spending side. Is there going to be a need, though, to bring in more revenue? Do we increase the sales tax? There's been concern that that hits certain people unfairly. Even if we're talking about a 7 to 8 year transition, are there replaceable revenues?
I certainly think there are, and it depends on where you go to find it. First is, you can think of the standard sort of songbook. It's just going back to the original sales tax, raising the rate, for instance, but we have relatively high sales tax rates as it is. Part of the reason for that is because we have what they call a very narrow sales tax base. Obviously, sales taxes and any tax really has two components, the rate and then what that rate applies to. We apply it to very few things in the state of Arizona relative to, say, Texas or Florida, states without income taxes. They have much broader sales tax bases. Some of the things that we don't tax in Arizona that are taxed in Texas and Florida are personal services, for instance. There's even some business services that are taxed. There's ways of doing this without creating too many economic distortions, and there's ways of doing it without actually hurting the poor as well. One thing that's a big item that most people leave off the table is food taxes. Most states don't tax food, and that's for the reason that we're concerned about the effect on the poor. Even if we tax some kind of personal business services, we can actually kind of take a page out of what happened with Prop 301 when we have that 0.6% sales tax increase. There's actually a component that gets kicked back to poor workers. Now, it's currently done through the income tax. We could do it through a rebate system, for instance. So if we're concerned about the poor, we shouldn't use it as a kind of club against overall tax reform and overall revenue neutral tax reform. I definitely think that there still could be some economic gains generated, even in the case where we're raising the same amount of revenue that we did before, because we do have a relatively low tax burden here in the state of Arizona, certainly when contrasted with the nation and also contrasted with where we were just 15 or 20 years ago. So I do think we can do revenue neutral tax reform in a way that still unlocks some job growth.
Jim, what about government? There's been concern, of course, that counties and cities and other municipalities may feel a hit from something like this, that they're going to have to perhaps raise taxes in their situation as if they're not getting as much revenue from the state. Should that be a concern?
It should be a concern, but I think that fits in within that dozen or so steps on that on what we may need to do. The unintended consequences, or maybe in this case, we would anticipate it. So it would be an intended consequence, but try to figure out how that might translate into extra business taxes. Because when a business is looking to locate here or expand, they don't just say, we're only going to look at the state tax rate. They say, what's our tax burden going to look like? So we have to figure out how that's going to work. And when we talk about tax structure, that's also different than trying to talk about how much revenue we're bringing in. In fact, that's another step, because we could lay out an efficient income tax code where it might be a little bit flatter, it might be a little bit more economically efficient by what you would typically see in a textbook. And I'm even an advocate of having a slightly flatter tax system, but where there might be debate on, well, what's the rate going to be? Mm-hmm. So can we still bring in enough money to pay for the basic things that the government's supposed to do? There's things that the government's supposed to do, and then there's things that the government is not supposed to do. And unfortunately, there's a little bit of a mix. Sometimes the government, you know, gets into areas that it shouldn't be, and then sometimes the government doesn't do some things that it should be. But that has to be part of that discussion. So I feel like, again, this is that first step in that longer debate, hopefully. But if you see this kind of degrade into this is the one report that's justifying a tax cut, I'm going to have a real problem with that, and I think a lot of people are as well. If this is part of a longer conversation over this next year, I think that maybe there could be some good progress.
Steve, final thoughts on this. I know we're sort of squeezing in this time, but I mean, you're thinking about in terms of what policy makes sense. You're approaching it from a fairly unemotional point of view. But politicians will, as Jim said, sort of use certain things to their advantage. Does that concern you that people are going to take sort of a phrase here and a phrase there, and they're going to say, well, you're mean to the poor in this situation. You're not thinking about them, even though we just addressed that a bit. Or you're going to say, well, this is sort of a talking point for Republicans. How do you make this so it actually seems like it would benefit the state in the long run?
Sure. I definitely think it's inevitable that you're going to have this push and pull in the politics. And that's just inevitable with the nature of public policy. I do think if we have these institutional structures in place, though, to make sure that we're auditing the budget on a fairly regular basis, thinking about what the proper role and scope of government is, doing the things it should be doing and doing less or not at all of the things as it shouldn't be doing, and that being the first kind of entry point to this broader discussion. Then we can think about generally speaking, we can expect to increase potential economic growth patterns and job creation in the state of Arizona, comparing ourselves to other states, not just recruiting businesses from other states, but also allowing homegrown entrepreneurship to blossom here in the state of Arizona. And one of the weird things about the income tax is that happens to be a more investment-heavy tax, as it is. And so thinking about the tax structure, not just level at which we tax, which I think is generally where the haggling comes in, but thinking about how we tax in the state of Arizona, that's going to be a much bigger discussion that could yield a lot more general benefit if we have this institutional understanding.
Stephen Slavinsky of the Center for the Study of Economic Liberty at ASU has a 30-page report on this. Jim Rounds, Senior Economist and Senior Vice President for Elliott D. Pollack & Company. We just touched on a little bit. We didn't get into too much of the nuances, but guys, thanks for the conversation. Appreciate
it.
Thank you.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. In just the past week or two, the Valley has seen visits from Jeb Bush, Carly Fiorina, Rand Paul, and Marco Rubio. All four are seen as likely Republican presidential candidates in the 2016 cycle. Paul talked about the NSA spying on Americans. Rubio emphasized his ties to Ronald Reagan's philosophies. Bush was criticized for giving different answers on whether he would have called for invading Iraq. But in visiting Arizona, none of the candidates seemed especially eager to talk about immigration reform, though the subject was touched on a bit. Joining me to talk about the candidates' visits to Arizona and whether immigration will become a major topic of discussion is ASU political scientist Rudy Espino. Rudy, welcome back.
Thank you for having me on.
Before we go specifically into immigration, what do you make so far of what these visits have meant? How big a deal do you think Arizona is going to be on the national stage going forward?
Big picture kind of thing is Arizona still does not matter. You know, it's not that, quote, purple state, right? So a big question is, why are all these GOP candidates coming to Arizona? And it just boils down to the topic of immigration, even though all the candidates are skirting around it. Because Arizona is that symbol of you're taking that, you know, drawing that hard line in the sand about immigration. And these candidates just want to make their appearance here, I guess, to appeal to the conservative Republican base as they head into the primary.
Do you think they can have nuanced conversations about this topic, or in the primaries, is it going to have to be, well, of course, we're going to emphasize border security first?
Yes. So you're appealing to the Republican electorate. You're going to have to talk about security first. And this is where we see some of the candidates that were moderates on immigration reform have shifted to the right. Most notably, you mentioned Bush, but also Marco Rubio, you know, both from Florida. You know, they used to be moderates, but they have now shifted to the right. And this is where we see all these candidates shifting to appeal to that Republican electorate. Perhaps Carly Fiorina is an exception to that. But the way she's talking about immigration, she's walking this fine line about talking about high-skilled labor versus low-skilled labor.
Which, of course, having her Silicon Valley experience, that's sort of a line she has to sort of straddle a bit. Do you think that's more complicated for her? And is there, I guess I wonder, we have this conversation probably every cycle. What do voters really make of candidates when they see Marco Rubio as part of the Gang of Eight writing this real comprehensive immigration reform? And he was out front on it and now sort of saying, he's sort of hemming and hawing. What do voters think when they hear that?
Well, for the average voter, they're not paying attention to that a whole lot, right? But when it comes to, you get further in the cycle, some of these candidates are going to drop out, then they head into the general election. You're going to be called out on that for flip-flopping, right? This is something that led to the demise of Kerry in 2004, you know, and so we've seen this flip-flopping from Rubio, from Bush. This is something that could catch up with them.
Is it an issue that the way we see primaries, the Republican primaries, it tends to be further right, Democratic primaries tends to be further left when it comes to who the actual high-efficacy voters are. But when it comes to an issue like this where there don't seem to be black and white answers in any sense, because some people will say, well, ultimately you have to deal with the 10 or 11 or 12 million undocumented immigrants who are here now, who have settled into lives here. We can't just send them back to, we've had the argument about dreamers, et cetera. Can there be a real in-depth conversation in the primary season about this that you see other than saying, well, you used to believe this, now you believe that? Do you think we're getting to a point now, even if the motive is just to get Latino votes?
On the Republican side, I don't see that just yet. You see these so-called moderates moving to the right. What I think will be the wake-up call is after the 2020 census. I mean, demographics are changing, mm-hmm. right? And as the GOP candidates continue to push this hard right position on comprehensive immigration reform, they're going to continue to lose the Latino electorate. And the country is changing, you know, and there are studies that show that by 2050, we're going to be a majority-minority country. And if the GOP field continues to push this, they're going to lose the hearts and minds of Latino voters out there.
But Rudy, I think you and I have even discussed this before, this idea of the monolith when it comes to Latino voters. Is there a situation where both sides are kind of pandering? Is there a way of looking at it where the Latino voters, just like any other voter, they want to hear, in some cases we all want to hear what we want to hear, but in truth they really wanted to vote for people who are leaders?
Yes, for Latino voters, aside from the economy, right, the most important issue for Latino voters is immigration reform, comprehensive immigration reform. You're not seeing that from the GOP. And frankly, for a lot of Latino voters, you're not seeing that from the Democratic field, because the Democratic Party is taking, frankly, it's for Latino voters, see them just taking their votes for granted. Mm-hmm. And Latino voters are not given an option, a real choice between, you know, who do you vote for, the right or the left? Because frankly, neither party has really pushed hard for comprehensive immigration reform.
Rita, there's been this analysis, too, whether Latinos will actually come out and vote. And obviously, some do, but at the percentage that people really want to see the impact from. Locally, there was more of a turnout when Sheriff DeArpaio last ran. But from a national standpoint, is there something, and I don't want to say, oh, you just, you know, wave a magic wand and you're going to do that, but are there certain things you think would actually get more Latinos feel like they're going to vote?
Yeah, and it is comprehensive immigration reform. If you have a candidate that says, I'm going to push this, I'm going to do this. I mean, we saw this a little bit with Barack Obama's, you know, where he made this exception with his executive order to change the deportation policy. Mm-hmm. And you saw in some polling from LatinoDecisions.com that Latino voters across the country shifted their attitude towards Barack Obama in terms of whether they felt he was strong on immigration reform versus whether he was not strong. And once he pushed for that executive order to change deportation policy, Latino voters, all of a sudden, approval for Barack Obama went up.
Rudy, final thought on this, and specifically just the Republicans. Do you think whoever wins the Republican primary will be determined by this issue? Will it be in the top two?
No, I don't think that. in part because, you have the Republican electorate or the Republican primary base, and what they just want to hear is somebody who's going to be talking about employment, the economy, and policies with respect to our involvement in foreign wars.
Arizona State University political scientist Rudy Espina. Rudy, thanks.
Thank you.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. So we just talked about what Republican candidates may or may not say or do on the campaign trail about the issue of immigration reform. But what about Democrats at the national level? Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton isn't expected to receive a significant primary challenge, though that could change. Is she talking about immigration reform, and how important is that for Democrats in 2016? In the most recent issue of The Nation and online at thenation.com, there's an editorial titled How Immigrants Have Changed the Democratic Party. With me to talk about that is features editor Kai Wright. Kai, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So how is Hillary Clinton's message on immigration different from what we heard from congressional Democrats, Democratic candidates in the last election cycle?
Well, it was striking here a couple of weeks back. She sat down in Las Vegas with a group of undocumented students and said a lot of things that particularly young immigration reform activists have been asking for from the party for a while. She said that not only does she support the president's executive actions on deportation relief, she said she would go further. She would expand it beyond the parents of children of U.S. citizens, parents of U.S. citizen children, to parents of undocumented children as well. So she got very aggressive on deportation relief. She talked about our detention system and this unsafe conditions there. She talked about immigration reform as a family values issue in general. And so it was quite a step forward from both what the president has done and certainly what the party has done in the past. And I think it surprised a lot of folks.
So considering what Hillary Clinton said, are National Democrats helped or hurt by President Obama's executive actions in immigration? And is he still seen by some as kind of that deporter in chief, as we've heard?
He is still seen by some as deporter in chief. He has enormous numbers of deportations, and I think that is the piece that that we didn't hear from Hillary Clinton, and that is still a question for the party. Is in this notion of comprehensive immigration reform, as we were just talking about, there's this bargain that the party has accepted that in order to create pathways to citizenship, in order to have deportation relief, there has to be a ramped up enforcement mechanism, and that ramped up enforcement mechanism is all we've seen over the course of the Obama administration, and it's led to record numbers of deportations. And so what remains is whether or not Hillary Clinton or anyone else in the Democratic Party is prepared to break the tie between these things, to say, you know what, we have enough enforcement. We do not need to continue ramping up enforcement. What we need to do is start making lives livable here in the United States. And so that I think that's still the unanswered question.
As Rudy Espino and I were just talking about in studio here in Phoenix, I'm sort of wondering whether this is a winning issue for Democrats. Again, talking about sort of that Latino monolith, which almost seems unfair to people that they're all going to sort of vote the same way.
Well, I mean, I think it is the case that immigration reform is high on folks' lists. Latino voters are like all other voters, right? And so I think the economy, I believe the polling numbers show that the economy is still the number one issue. But immigration reform really touches a lot of folks' lives. And I think that's why you've seen such strong activism, particularly, again, from youth in the last few years, because you're reaching a point when you have 2 million deportations, you're reaching a point where there's not a lot of families who haven't been touched by this in some way. So, and that's very personal. Those are very personal ties. And so I think if you can get to a place where you're proposing policy that really does create relief for families, then I do think it's going to be a motivator at the polls.
Kai, certainly foreign policy in the sense of what we're going to do in the Middle East and that sort of thing will certainly be a major issue in the 2016 general election, even if the world changes a little bit. But once we get to whoever the Democratic nominee is, whoever the Republican nominee is, immigration policy at the national level, is that going to be a really key issue that we're going to hear real answers about?
I think what you're seeing, part of the reason that Hillary Clinton came out so strong so early in her campaign is that I think Democrats hope it will be. They certainly hope that it will be a problem for Republicans. They have a range of different beliefs in the GOP about this that are in conflict. I think it is going to come up in the primary. I would agree with the previous person that it's not going to be definitive, but it can complicate the conversation on the Republican side, and I think Democrats will be eager to talk about it because it will be very difficult for both in the Republican primary and then in the general for Republicans to articulate a posture on this that'll both satisfy their base and without alienating huge swaths of the electorate.
Kai Wright is features editor for The Nation. In the most recent issue, there's an editorial titled How Immigrants Have Changed the Democratic Party. Kai, thank you for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about charity fraud, and we'll get a history of Martin Luther King Day in Arizona. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by University of Arizona Eller MBA, with two programs for working professionals in downtown Phoenix and 100% online option. Details about the Thursday, May 21st info session at ellermba.com.
Good morning. It's KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. We'll have a high of 93 degrees today in the valley, 90 tomorrow. Look for some breezes on Friday with partly to mostly sunny skies through the work week, and then highs in the mid to upper 80s for the weekend. In valley traffic right now on I-10 eastbound, we're still seeing a report of an accident on the 7th Avenue exit ramp. Coming up at 12 o'clock, we'll have NPR's Here and Now. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule next month on the constitutionality of Oklahoma's death penalty. And the Federal Trade Commission says the charity Cancer Fund of America was a fraud, with its founder spending $200 million in contributions on vacations and cars. Here and Now from Boston starts at noon. Right now, it's partly sunny in the valley and 84 degrees at 11:44.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A Tennessee man and his family used much of the $187 million collected for cancer patients to buy themselves cars and take luxury cruise vacations, according to federal officials. They alleged that yesterday in one of the largest charity fraud cases ever involving all 50 states. The joint action by the Federal Trade Commission and the states says James T. Reynolds Sr., his ex-wife and son raised the money through their various charities, including the Breast Cancer Society in Mesa. The Breast Cancer Society agreed to cease operations as part of the settlement agreement. With us to talk about how this can happen is Daniel Borikoff, president and founder of Charity Watch. Daniel, thank you for being with us.
Yes, hello. Glad to be here.
So how does this kind of alleged charity fraud happen? Is it more common than we'd like to think?
Well, it could happen very easily because, unfortunately, the regulation is really weak. It takes place mainly at the state level. The states are starved in terms of having funding to hire, you know, serious lawyers and accountants that can go after this. There's many different charities that are going over the line, and so they can only really pick out the worst abusers. But even in this case, Charity Watch has been giving Cancer Fund of America an F grade since we started back in 1993. I mean, the charity started in 1987. So there's the weak regulation. There's also the accountability vacuum. There's a lot of misreporting going on that's being allowed. The accounting rules that are approved by the FASB, you know, are way too weak. And it doesn't make sense that groups can hide tens of millions of dollars of international in-kinds and not have to say where they're giving it to them or what exactly they are. It really makes no sense. But that's the accounting rules in which nonprofits and charities operate under at current.
So, Daniel, since you're talking about more than 20 years, you know, briefly tell us what stood out that you saw these red flags related to the Cancer Fund here.
Well, they're giving 85% of the money to the professional fundraising company right off and only spending about 3% on anything charitable. That stands out. The family members, just a whole slew of the husband, son. I mean, my experience is when you have a lot of family members involved in a charity, the internal controls break down, they don't work, and it's too easy for abuse to happen. Also, these goods being sent around the world without telling you where they're going or what exactly they are, you know, certainly makes you, you know, certainly raises a lot of questions.
Now, Charity Watch is not a psychological organization, so I'm going to ask you a question that might sound odd, but does this happen with people who are intending to commit fraud, or do they intend to do good work and then they just get caught up in, hey, we're collecting a lot of money, I'd like to keep it?
Well, it can be people that are actually well-intentioned but get taken advantage of by certain business interests like fundraising companies or other vendors that use the charity as a way to enrich themselves. What the outside vendor will do is promise some money to the charity, but then the charity only gets a very small percentage. So if you dangle like $1 million in front of some mom and pop charity, I mean, the fundraising company may spend $10 million to raise that $1 million, so the charity will be, you know, maybe the charity is a bit greedy or self-centered, and they'll go, oh, well, we'll take it. It's money we wouldn't ordinarily have, but the fallacy of that way of thinking is also money that other charities won't have, and more importantly, that the intended recipients, the needy people that, you know, need the help and the aid will not receive the assistance.
Daniel, where do you think the increased government scrutiny or regulation should come from? And I mean, are there places that make obvious sense to you that if we invested a little more, it would have a big impact?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the IRS needs to be doing more because there's all this filing and public disclosure through the IRS, and yet there's not that much, that much oversight and regulatory actions taking place by the IRS. That would be a big help. But it really gets down to the donor being more informed, because right now only 30% of the donors go beyond what the charity itself, when it asks for the money, is telling the donor. So donors need to hone in and think about what actually they're funding and what's actually going on. But there really ought to be like an SEC of the charity world, because it's a separate matter. It's different types of reporting and oversight that are needed, and we really need a some kind of government entity that could at a national level, you know, oversee the charities. I mean, they have the Charity Commission in the UK. I mean, I think we need something like that here in the USA.
Daniel Borikoff is president and founder of Charity Watch. Daniel, thanks for fitting us in for a few minutes. We appreciate it.
Sure. Glad to talk to you.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Nearly three decades ago, Evan Meekum became Arizona's governor, and it didn't take long for him to generate national controversy. Meekum rescinded the order of his predecessor, Bruce Babbitt, that declared a holiday honoring Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Arizona. It took a number of years and conflicting ballot measures, but Arizona eventually became the first state with a voter-approved King Day. One of the leaders in making that a reality is Reverend Warren Stewart, longtime pastor of the First Institutional Baptist Church in Phoenix. He tells the story of the holiday coming to fruition in the new book, Victory Together for Martin Luther King Jr. We started our conversation by talking about Governor Babbitt's visit to First Institutional Baptist.
It was Sunday, May 18th, 1986. Bruce Babbitt came to our 8 o'clock service at that time, and he said, I want to declare this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday from the pulpit of the First Institutional Baptist Church. Art Hamilton was there. He was minority speaker. Many other community leaders were there, and it was history.
So at the time, were you celebrating? Were you thinking, this is good news, but this doesn't mean the end of the story?
Well, it was good news, but Governor Babbitt said something in his presentation. He said, now, I'm doing this, but you're going to have to fight for this. So it's kind of, he knew in the back of his mind that he might have been on shaky ground, and he said, you're going to have to fight for this. We didn't know what kind of fight he meant, but it turned out to be a 6.5-year fight.
Then take us through when Governor Meekum came in, and if it wasn't his first act, it was one of his early acts to rescind that order. Initial reaction by you and the community, how did people feel?
State Attorney General Corbin at the time was Republican, and he said that Governor Babbitt did not have the authority to do it. But, of course, he was the governor. So when Governor Meekum won that election, when nobody thought he would win in November 1986, I guess a news reporter asked him, you know, you said you would rescind the King holiday. Are you going to do it? He said, yes, I am. I'm going to rescind the King holiday. It's not legal, and Martin Luther King Jr. is not at the stature of presidents, Washington and Lincoln. And so we met with him shortly after he won the election in several state leaders from around the state. There were African Americans, clergy. There was a Jewish rabbi leaders there. And we tried to get him to say no, you know, to not rescind. He said, no, I'm going to rescind. He said, you never get, you black people don't need a holiday. You folks need jobs.
Was Meekum a racist?
I called him a racist. I called him a racist. I believe he was.
Okay.
I believe he was.
Do you think that matters in the big picture when we look back at this
story?
Well,
I mean, America is ingrained with systemic racism. And so if he wasn't a racist, he was part of a systemic racist system that discriminated against people of color for centuries, mm-hmm. for decades. So, yeah.
Was this a community that had talked about systemic racism any more than any other community? Was there a feeling that the population wasn't so great, that people weren't giving it as much attention as maybe you thought they
well,
should?
Well, even Governor Babbitt, who was considered an ally of people of color, of African Americans, he would throw up in our face when we would meet with him, African American leaders, well, you know, you all are only 3%. Mm. And he would just, I mean, and he was an ally. So if as an ally, he brought up, you're only 3%, you know, and when we try to get him to do things on public education, economic development. So that was around, but see, the whole genesis of the King holiday is that Martin Luther King helped America live out its Constitution, its founding fathers' dream in some respects for liberty and justice for all. And so we had to move people to understand this is not a black holiday. This is an American holiday.
Do you see people viewing Martin Luther King Jr. in a different way now than they did 30 years ago? And I mean even just the average middle-class white person.
Well, certainly, because when we started, polls were taken, and 70% of Arizonans did not support the King holiday. So from that 6.5-year period from when it was declared in the pulpit of the First Assembly Baptist Church, when we finally won on November the 3rd, 1992, we had to move people 100%. Or we moved them 100% in the opposite direction. By the time it won by 66%, which was 2-1. But the key was to educate people that Martin Luther King helped America to be the real America it intended, its founders intended it to be, liberty and justice for all. And we were successful, thank God, and moved people.
Considering what people were saying to you about, well, this is a black holiday or this is a brown holiday, why did you think it was important to fight in that bigger sense and not just say, I'm going to say my piece? And why did you feel the need to be a leader on this?
Because I felt that Dr. King's legacy and ministry and contribution to the nation had been insulted. Insulted, perhaps, not out of meanness, but ignorance. And so I saw this as an assignment to elevate people's understanding and perception of the significance of Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement. So for me, it was a mission.
What really turned the tide after 5.5, 6 years?
Money, the boycotts, the Super Bowl, the conventions and events, concerts that canceled here. First one, Stevie Wonder down in Tucson, January of 1987, and it steamrolled, snowballed, but the ultimate one was in the 1989-ish when we were trying to get the Super Bowl here in 1993, and my dear good friend now, Bill Shover, was the chair of the Super Bowl committee, and he responded and said, Reverend, I would like us to talk. It was money that got the powers that be on board to push this. And, of course, it didn't happen all of a sudden because it was passed twice in legislature, overturned by referendum, put on the ballot in 1990, two different ones, defeated. But finally in 92, it was overwhelmingly.
When we think about money sort of turning the tide on things, does motive matter or does the outcome matter?
I had a challenge working with the Phoenix 40 when we finally did work together and the business community, because I always questioned, do they really want this for the right reason, or do they want this because this is the only way Arizona can join that elite club of cities in the nation that hosts the Super Bowl? And to be very frank, I think the majority worked with us for the Super Bowl, but there were converts along the way.
How important is a boycott as an element of these things for people to really see the light?
Well, as a disciple of both Jesus Christ and Martin Luther King Jr., I studied the way Martin King led the civil rights movement. And there were progressive steps. You speak with the powers that be. Once you identify there's a racial issue, you try to get them to come on board. If that doesn't work, then you lobby them. You build your support base. If that doesn't work, then you have public demonstrations when that doesn't work. And on down, and about the fifth step, is an economic boycott. And if they don't do the first four steps, then you move to the boycott. And after the boycott is civil disobedience. And we were almost at the point of about to be arrested for the King holiday, but that's when the business community got involved and they came on board. But we were planning civil disobedience because we didn't think that the boycott was working, but it began to work as it mounted up. Yeah.
The name of the book is Victory Together. The author is Reverend Warren Stewart of First Institutional Baptist Church in Phoenix. Always a pleasure to have you here. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve. God bless you.
And that's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks very much to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on the program. And thanks to you for listening. If you missed any of our segments, including conversations about Martin Luther King Day or eliminating the personal income tax in Arizona, go online to kjzz.org this afternoon. You can also download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. You can also follow the program on Twitter at KJZZ Here and Now. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. NPR's Here and Now is up next. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great rest of the day. It's 12 o'clock.